This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just a decade after it became ubiquitous, the World Wide Web has made us blasé about information. We assume we can learn almost everything about almost anything at the touch of a keyboard. But the revolution is hardly over. Now, the digital realm is exploding into the physical world. They call it the geospatial web. Already, it means online maps loaded with information about the physical world. And someday soon, that physical world itself will be tagged and teeming with data for the asking. What is that building? Where is my dog? Who is that man? The implications? Huge, exciting, scary. A world alive with information. Up next on Point, tracking the geospatial web. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Mike Leipold, senior researcher at the Institute for the Future Research and Forecasting Group. Mike Leipold, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. We want to wade in slowly here. We'll have people who are already galloping across this horizon and others barely familiar with it. What is the geospatial web, Mike?
The geospatial web, or GeoWeb for short, is a combination of map data, digital map data, combined with web-like hypermedia, web pages, video, audio objects, graphic objects that are tagged with location coordinates in addition to a URL.
So, meaning I can now point to a map, bore in on a given point, and find out all kinds of information about what's at that physical, that geographical point.
Well, or as you move through the world, if your device knows where it is, if it's location sensitive, it can retrieve information about the area, the place, and the objects around you.
So we're not talking about necessarily, we could be sitting at a PC here, but we're also in the world with what kind of device? With a BlackBerry, with a portable, a cellular telephone, something else?
Well, all of the above. It could be a device like a Swiss Army knife that has location sensing, telephone capabilities. It could be a handheld computer. It might also be a music player. Or it might be what is come to be called a personal information ensemble. You might have an earbud in your ear, which is connected wirelessly to a telephone that you've got clipped on your belt. You might have a necklace with a camera. You might have a wristband with a keypad. We're going to have a whole range of devices for augmented perception.
So on the one hand, we're in the world with a device that can tap into web information. I guess you're assuming that that device has got GPS, geographic positioning satellite connection, so that it knows where it is or can see or sense where other things are.
Well, there's a variation of geolocation techniques. GPS is only one. It's also possible to identify your location by listening to Wi-Fi hotspots, or to cellular telephone towers, or even television towers.
Let's start with maps, because we're going to have to take this a bite at a time. It's a lot to chew on here. Give us some examples, if you would, Mike, of the kinds of things now being done with maps on the Internet. As we know, with no special devices, really, the kind of information and services that are emerging in this geo-web realm.
Well, there's two things happening with maps on the Internet. One is people have taken Google Maps. The programming interface on Google Maps is simple enough so that people can take a little bit of code and paste the code into a web page and render Google Maps on their own web pages and then add points of interest themselves or annotations, geo-annotations, on their own web pages.
Is this what people call mashups, where they're mashing information onto the Google map, let's say?
Yes. Microsoft and Yahoo are now coming along with very similar capabilities, but the shortcomings of these techniques is that you can't integrate mashups from two sources.
So you can't have the information from more than one website integrated with that single map.
Right. If you had created a list of annotations about Harvard Square, for example, and showed them on your website. Mm-hmm. And then I came along and I created a list of notes on Harvard Square, mm-hmm. and put them on my website. It wouldn't be possible for viewers to view them simultaneously. That requires a technology called GIS, Geographical Information Systems. And that is the other revolution on the web. And that is that map information is becoming available on the web in new standard open formats that allows data to be integrated in a single view, data from multiple sources.
So ultimately, data from many sources about a particular location or a person traveling in space that we could retrieve. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Even with the systems available already, can you share with us some of the services that are out there, some of them businesses and some of them just kind of wild stuff launched on the web that are already functioning?
Well, there's a lot of experimentation. For the last two or three years, there's been a vibrant underground movement of computer programmers, digital mappers, artists, and political activists have been using these techniques experimentally. There's a group called the Locative Media Lab. It is an informal group of collaborators across Northern Europe, New York, Boston, and San Francisco, and some in Japan and Korea, who've been creating experimental applications, mainly in the fields of arts and often sponsored by arts foundations. So that, for example, as you move through the streets of Amsterdam with a Palm Pilot that's equipped with location sensing, you can hear people's stories about the streets of Amsterdam.
So their memories, their anecdotes, that's a kind of almost a literary use of the GeoWeb. I'm looking here at very practical things, for example, from Chicago, where crime statistics were overlaid with a map of Chicago, and suddenly you could see exactly what was happening where and what quantity.
Well, There are two other kind of categories of things happening on the internet besides these experimental applications. Mm-hmm. The application you described was a Google mashup where someone took the police reports, geocoded them, which mm-hmm. means adding location coordinates for each incident,
right,
and laid them on a Google map. But these kinds of civic maps are created every day all across the world. Mm-hmm. In standard map formats and layered together. But often this information has not been widely accessible. For example, my daughter is a runner and recently spent some time in Sacramento, California.
Yeah.
And she wanted to take a run along the running trails in American River. Some of the places are really wonderful for athletics for a young woman. Other places are high incidence of muggers.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that that kind of public incident information would be available, and often it's not. So there are a range of civic applications. There are a range of commercial applications as well that people are already offering. The telephone companies, the mobile phone companies offer some limited location services in what might be called walled gardens, in that you can only get the information provided by the mobile network carrier. Yellow Pages information about stores or pre-packaged points of interest, historical points. And in most cases, you can't get out to a location-enabled web from a mobile phone because the phone companies want to control the access to commercial information,
right,
for their own commercial benefit.
But as you say, there's a kind of democratization going on here where I can or will soon in more places be able to figure out what movies showing where that might be near me, apartments that are for rent in a specific area that I can get to by map, maybe even where my friends are at a given moment in time. We're going to look at a lot of this, but the big vision way down the road, Mike, it seems to be that lots and lots of things and people would be stationary in the world or walking around in the world with data attached to them that one could access any time, at any place, to find out who is that, what is that, where is that?
Well, right now we're limited in what we know about the world as we move around by what we carry around inside our heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we've learned, what we've read, what someone has told us. So you can you can kind of conduct a little thought exercise yourself as you walk through the world. Imagine that as you look at an object, you can see information that someone has added. You might look at a tree and see a note that a forester left that talked about the way that the tree has been cared for. You might be moving through a forest and see information about an ecosystem. Or you might be moving down the street, and as you move through the street, you can see the wares and the price lists and the menu offerings from the merchants on a street.
Look at a person, I mean, I'm reading here in some of the literature on this about each of us kind of carrying around a record of ourselves that would be readable by anybody, anytime?
Not really, no. There's an enormous concern for personal privacy, and there are a number of initiatives to give people control of what information they disclose to themselves in a wireless environment. And the Internet Engineering Task Force, for example, has a whole set of new standard practices for location or contextual privacy.
Jeff's calling right now from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
Well, I have a huge website that I post all photographs and trip logs from my sailing trips through the Caribbean. And when I found Google Earth, I went off and I created this very large Google Earth database, which linked all of my trip logs, the text pieces, mm-hmm. and my photo albums together on a Google Earth, so that when you go there, you can click on, they call them placemarks.
You really click on an image of the planet, a satellite image of the Caribbean in this case.
And so in this case, you can see all these different placemarks, which show where different places that I've anchored. And you click on it, and it brings up my web pages showing text and photos of the places, and also photo albums.
So of your experience as a sailor in these very specific, intimate locations now available to the whole world through Google Earth.
That is correct, right. And I've had, tens of thousands of downloads of this Google Earth database. Lots and lots of people have gone off and looked at this. I get tons of good feedback from it.
It's a great example, Sailor Jeff. Where do you think this is headed?
I just hope that more and more people do this, because it's a great way to explore the world cyberly. And a lot of people could never do this by themselves, or if they're thinking about going to one of these places, they just can pull up this information and learn from what other people have already done.
There's going to be a lot of interest in websites. And by the way, we've got a link at our website, onpointradio.com, to a lot of sites to do with the geospatial web. What's yours, Jeff?
Well, mine is jeffschultz.org, but it's spelled Geoffschultzorg.
All right, Caribbean sailors, there you go. Everything you need to know about a safe port in a storm. Jeff, thanks very much for your call. I want to invite another voice into our conversation from New York. We're joined by Christopher Allen. He's a founding partner of Counts Media. They're creators of Yellow Arrow. It's described as a global public art and technology project. Christopher Allen, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So, Yellow Arrow, what is it? I'm out in the world and I see a yellow arrow posted on something. What's that about?
Well, when you see a yellow arrow, you know that there's more there than meets the eye, some hidden detail, a funny story, a crazy experience that someone's had, and each arrow links someone's experience or a thought or idea to a real location by using the symbol and actually text messaging. People place yellow arrows because they've got something to say about where that yellow arrow is pointing, and then that their thought is then forever tagged to that location.
So you've got ordinary people out in the world who happen to have your yellow arrow decal. They affix it to some object, and they make a note about that object. Anybody else comes along with what? Their PDA, their BlackBerry, their cell phone, and they can punch in the code on that particular arrow and learn what this person had to say about it.
Exactly, yeah. The most used version of the symbol is a sticker, and people place it, and each sticker has a unique code on it, and they you send a text message with that code to the yellow arrow phone number, and you get back the message of the person who placed the sticker. So in that way, it's a very simple means of actually leaving messages on location without necessarily having to use GPS, without having to use Wi-Fi. We launched the publication in May of 2004 as an experiment, and since then, people from all over the world have gotten stickers online, have been placing them to sort of map out their world. And we call this an MAAP, a massively authored artistic publication.
I love it. Give us some examples of where yellow stickers are and what I might learn about the objects they're stuck on.
Absolutely. You know, people that we have in the gallery of yellow arrows, people add photographs and map their arrows online, even though it can be a completely mobile experience.
Yep.
The website is very rich, and people can place comments, et cetera.
Like what?
So people, one comment actually that I placed, which was pretty shocking, was on an arrow that was pointing to a building in Copenhagen that had these very intense architectural lines on it, and it said, "What can you imagine happening in this space? You know, please comment to reply." And so, someone, you know, walking along that bridge in Copenhagen may have text messaged that, and then they could reply to the message and leave their thought about that place. Well, I saw sort of the potential for a large scale projection of Tetris on the side of this building.
The game Tetris.
And so one morning, I just on the web, I text that to the author, and it actually relayed, Yellow Arrow relays the SMS message from the website to the actual author. And I said, I see this game of Tetris being played with people using their mobile phones, and there's a big competition, and it's a big festival in the city, and wouldn't that be fun? And in fact, the man who received that text message is pursuing that project, and the building, it turns out, is the National Bank of Denmark.
So there's an example of kind of whimsy behind the yellow arrow. I have a colleague who put a yellow arrow on a candy factory that if you punched in the code, it would inform you that the guard at that factory would give you candy if you simply asked a kind of information. Where do you see all this going, Christopher Allen? This is still relatively rudimentary with often paper stickers on things, but down the road, everything going to have information attached to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, you know, one of the most important aspects or the most interesting aspects of this technology is going to be based around community and sharing information that's important to people. What we're most interested in this application is a community that's sort of sharing entertaining and enriching details about the world around them that kind of bring people more deeply into, you know, their environment so that they can experience sort of the thoughts and ideas of other people.
Yeah. Let's take a call. David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. That's the perfect lead into what I was going to say, which is that the exact same kind of application can and already is saving lives. I'm a Homeland Security consultant,
okay.
And my particular emphasis is on ways of, particularly post-Katrina, to try to empower the general public so that we can take care of ourselves to the greatest extent possible. And one of the things that I suggested right during Katrina, and then people actually picked up on it, is there's a great mashup called Flickr Memory Maps, where you can tag, for example, you know, a house where you lived 30 or 40 years ago and tell a little bit of the history, and then over time it builds a whole history of the house. But in the case of Katrina, people could put a tag on, sad to say, a rooftop and say, you know, I know that there's an elderly woman in there who I'm afraid might not have been able to get out, so that people could concentrate their efforts on trying to locate people that way. And I think there's also another really important aspect of this that makes it even more valuable in a whole variety of ways, is that you can increasingly, it's not just location-based,
yes,
but also real-time. And so that means, again, going back to Homeland Security, that instead of the one-size-fits-all evacuation plans, you could, in fact, customize those based on where somebody is right now.
But, David, does that mean that we all, or those who care to, are going to have a chip somewhere in their shoe, behind their ear? Or
you know, in fact,
how will you know where I am right now?
Examples of this is a rather low-tech version of it, which is a company called Dodgeball.com, which Google bought recently. So you know that if Google bought them,
they think it's going somewhere. Yep.
Where they are able to locate you through triangulation with a cell phone. Basically, what you do is if you put all of your friends' cell phone numbers in, their database, and you're at a bar that is participating or a restaurant, and that doesn't mean that they've got any equipment. It just means that they have registered their geographic location so that...
So you want to know who's around, who's
yeah, the cool thing, then on a social basis, what
yes.
happens is it sends out a message, if you alert them that you're there,
yeah.
All you have to do is one text message to Dodgeball. It sends out a text message to all of your friends, but here's the cool thing, only those who at that particular moment
yes.
are within a 10-block radius of the place that you're at. So in a social situation, that means that you're not bothering people who are on the other side of the country who, obviously couldn't come. But
if you're nearby and want to get together, here we are, and let's go.
Yeah, exactly. So in the case of a disaster, then you all get together for a quick shot of something or other else and figure out how you're going to survive.
Yeah, or maybe a quick shot out of town. David, it's wonderful. Thank you very much for your call. Mike Liebold, how about it? There's an idea, Flickr memory maps, attaching information, as David says, to a house. I mean, maybe you'd move into a house and what? Click on there and find out all kinds of things about who's lived there, experiences that have happened there. I mean, there's the old saw about if walls could talk, we'd all be in trouble, or might be. It sounds as though we're approaching that.
Well, not exactly. No, a lot of information is going to remain private. There are lots and lots of initiatives and technical developments underway to preserve people's privacy and the privacy of their locations. The only information that may be publicly available is civic data. There might be building reports available about a building. There might be information about the conduits in the street.
But that's already not true. I mean, look at Flickr memory maps, or look at what Christopher Allen's doing. Anybody can walk by, tag some information on a building, or perhaps one day a person, and that information is there, isn't it?
Well, that's an external observation. It may or may not be true, and there's going to be a question of the validity of information. In many cases, users will have an ability to correct these things, as they do with the Wikipedia. You could, if someone has posted some false information, you could correct it. By the way, I wanted to mention something
yes.
very interesting about Yellow Arrow. Is right now, while these notes are queued by physical objects,
right.
In the future, that information can appear automatically, digitally, without affixing a piece of material or graffiti on the physical environment.
How will that work?
Just the location coordinates alone would be enough to retrieve a note that someone may have left on a place.
And suddenly you have sort of objects speaking to us as we pass by. I want to get another call here before the break. Joe is calling from Huntsville, Alabama. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're very well. What do you know, Joe?
Well, I'm the editor and publisher of Directions Magazine. We follow this industry quite closely. And the point I was going to make was all of these applications that seem to have a very nice consumer benefit also have a business benefit.
Such as?
Customers who would be using this for logistics planning, like a FedEx or McDonald's, who are doing this for site planning. They're integrating this geospatial technology into their mainstream enterprise computing information systems so that at the fingertips they can retrieve the information and get sales data, marketing data, even where their trucks are located.
Joe, we have a sense that that's happening already, that Walmart knows where every Barbie doll is, you know, en route from China to you name it. Where's it going?
Well, that's absolutely true, but they're early adopters. There are many businesses who are not utilizing this, even small to medium-sized businesses, who actually could are it's very affordable to them. Microsoft has a very unique product that's really relatively low end, but all of this is all of the data is becoming much more affordable and much more available, as Mike Liebold is pointing out.
How close are we to the age, Joe, when I was joking earlier, but let's say I want a purple hula hoop, I can ask my BlackBerry or cell phone or computer and it will tell me the closest store that has one on the shelf ready to buy?
Well, we're not that far away. I mean, obviously, you'd like to have access to that information. You'd like to have the real-time inventory information. Obviously, as you said, Walmart has this information at their fingertips. How soon it will get to the actual consumer is a good question.
Joe, thanks very much for your call. Mike?
I just wanted to comment that actually the service you described is available today. Google's shopping service called Frugal mm-hmm. now has a local capability that allows you to type in a name of a product, a purple hula hoop, and it will show you a map of all the retailers nearby that have purple hula hoops for sale and at what price.
Christopher Allen, let me ask you, many internet users will be familiar with Wikipedia, the encyclopedia that's created by anybody adding what they want to add. Some scandal about that lately down in, what was it, Tennessee or Kentucky, where we had some bogus information put up. But are you seeing something like that emerging in the physical world, that objects all over the place, tagged whether by yellow arrows or elsewise, by people saying, here's what I know about this person, place, or thing?
Yeah, I believe that it's going to happen. I think especially with place, people have a lot to say about it. There's so many stories that and ideas and thoughts that people can contribute, that, you know, place is such a huge component of our lives. And taking this kind of digital content and bringing it out into the physical world can actually make it much more, I think, useful and rich to the way that we experience it.
Is that going to, do you welcome that, Christopher, or is it, you know, do we want a world that's yammering data at us?
I think I welcome it in the case that it's going to enrich my experience. I don't necessarily welcome the idea of geo-spam, which would be the idea of companies advertising to me based on my location. I don't welcome the idea of having too much data or data that I didn't request. But I think that, you know, something that stops me in my everyday life and says, hey, check this, you know, here's a thought, here's an idea, and is a new sort of social experiment or experience, and is fun, is something that I'm interested in.
We're joined now as well from Ann Arbor, Michigan, by Peter Morville, writer and web designer. He's author of Ambient Findability: What We Find Changes Who We Become. Peter Morville, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You are writing about UFOs, and you mean something entirely new, at least new to me here, ubiquitous findable objects. What's that?
What I'm talking about there is the increasing ability to track the location of objects, whether that's products in the supply chain or our physical possessions, our pets, and...
Or our physical selves.
And, of course, yes, the scary part is tracking people's locations.
Give us the range that you see. There must be wonderful applications of this. There must be scary applications of this. Paint the horizon for us, Peter.
Well, one of my favorite devices for making people think about this future is this watch, the Wearify wireless watch. And it's got a GPS positioning system built in. And essentially, you buy it for your child, and it locks onto their wrist mm-hmm. with a special key fob. And then you can track the location of your child wherever they go. And, you know, some people recoil in horror from the idea of tracking your child's location. Other people, and you'll see this on Amazon, people who have bought the product, instead complain that it doesn't work well enough. You know, from my perspective, there's some very interesting and useful applications that most people would agree to. For instance, when you take your child to a large amusement park like Disney World, and you're able to kind of keep track of them during the course of the day, and if they become lost, you're able to very quickly find them.
But are we going to be walking around trackable all the time and with our lives kind of readable by anybody who wants to read it? Or is it going to take a new framework of laws to protect us from that trackability, that open book nature, or is that unavoidable if anybody can tag annotations onto us digitally?
I think that the technology is racing ahead of society and certainly ahead of our laws and our ethics and our sort of notion of what's acceptable. There's a new book out by Catherine Albrecht called Spy Chips, which really talks about radio frequency ID tags and the ability there, if you buy a pair of shoes that has a tag in it, the ability of authorities or corporations to track your location. And in my opinion, that book kind of raises, you know, maybe goes a little too far in terms of the conspiracy theory. But, you know, there are very valid concerns that we need to be having serious conversations about now.
Peter, Mike, I want to turn to our callers again. Lee's calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, everyone.
Hi.
I'm a long-haul truck driver and from Oregon. I'm here in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, waiting to unload.
Okay.
And, you know, I have a satellite communication system on my truck, and also a GPS, whatever you call this thing on the truck.
Tracking system. And, so I'm betting your boss knows where your truck is all the time.
It's terrible. It's no fun at all. You know, I feel I'm on the receiving end of these devices, and all of them, you know, they know where I am, they know what I'm doing. You know, they know if I've been good and they know if I've been bad.
Now, what does that mean exactly, Lee? Does it mean, I mean, you, before you could what? Pull off and...
I will give you a very practical example. Before I could pull off and take a nap somewhere. If I got tired, I'd pull off and take a nap, and there would be no consequence. It would be between me and my nap.
And you'd have to, you'd make up the time or be late, but it was
whatever. We were on time or whatever, but
right.
it would still be, you know, something I had to deal with, and it was just...
And what about now, Lee? What about now?
And now, you know, people know if I'm taking a nap. They can say, you know, hey, how come you're not moving?
Right. Get that truck on the road.
Get that truck on the road. Do this, do that. You know. I mean, to me, it's a lot more malevolent as opposed to being a novelty device for the leisure class.
We hear it loud and clearly. Where what you're up to is always on somebody's big moving map. Mike Leopold, how about it? There's a very practical application already out in the world.
Sure. There are actually quite a few of these. Shipping and logistics is one. Another is civic workers understanding built environments, buildings, or facilities. Health workers using location devices to track and map health zones or epidemics. Farmers are using GPS technology to precisely map the growing characteristics of every square centimeter of a field.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of grassroots movements as well. There are people in tribal areas that are using mapping techniques to record cultural history. There's a group in Central America called the GPSistas that are creating their own maps for political purposes.
Because as we read, many parts of the world, map information is not as widely available, freely disseminated as in the United States. But now with the combination of satellite images, online maps, people tagging their own information on there, kind of democratically created maps in the world.
Absolutely. Well, there's a movement started by a group of people in London called the Open Map Movement to make digital maps available free to the public. In the UK and in many places in the world, digital maps are available only by sale and only for copyright use. Instead, a group of hackers got some GPS devices and are slowly creating their own map of London that can be distributed freely among all the people.
But Mike, what's your sense of a citizen like Lee, who's already feeling not empowered by this, but enslaved by this?
Well, there's lots of technology and social movements to preserve privacy. There are location techniques that allow you to know where you are that don't disclose it to other people. And, for example, with RFID chips...
This is the radio frequency ID that would beam out from wherever you are if you're wearing it or have it on or in.
It doesn't beam. It only works if a radio shines on it. It's an inert signal device that has no radio power of its own. And people have developed jammers. So you could clip a little jammer on your belt, and as you move around the world, you would be immune from surveillance.
Peter, you mentioned earlier, I buy a pair of shoes and they've got an RFID tag in them. Now, even if it's not beaming out, of course, it could be read all over the place. Are there laws today that keep a shoe manufacturer from implanting that, or could they just go ahead and do it right now?
I don't believe that there are laws against it. The issue of the reader comes into play. You know, every store has those anti-theft devices in the doorways.
Right.
Well, those are now being upgraded to read radio frequency ID chips. So theoretically, as you move in and out of any store that has these readers, they would know, okay, here comes Peter. Oh, Peter's left the store. And on the highways with the automated toll booths, that's another opportunity to read that little tag in your shoe. So, again, I'm not sure if anybody's doing this, but that's the problem. We don't really know.
Rich is calling from Boston. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been on the Internet for a very long time, over 30 years counting the ARPANET. So
are you calling in on the Internet right now, Rich?
No, I'm not. Hold on just a second.
Okay. It sounds kind of...
Yeah, hi. Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, so I've had a chance to watch the neighborhood go downhill, as it were.
What do you mean by that?
Some of your earlier callers have touched on it, things like spam and the poisoning of the Wikipedia. Right.
So it's not always sweetness and light. What do you see in the geo-web era?
Well, what concerns me is that there's already a push on the current Internet to move towards, back towards, I guess, the walled garden, as your guest mentioned before.
That is privately owned information that you pay for access to.
Exactly. And it's been resisted by the fact that the Internet is really such a public, open space, and it was designed that way.
But isn't the physical world is even more open, isn't it, or not?
It is, but this isn't the physical world. This is a portal into the physical world, this geoweb. And I see a risk that companies are going to say, we'll keep you safe if you access it through our service, and turn it basically into a bunch of competing yellow pages where you have to pay to get your information in, and if you don't pay, you're on the outside.
So in other words, you won't exist in the geo web world unless you pay to be part of a kind of spatial yellow pages. That's your fear anyway.
Yeah, that's the fear. I'm wondering if anybody is considering what the risks are as this geo web develops, and taking steps to put standards in place now that will keep those anticipated risks from coming to pass.
Yeah, Rich, let us pick that up. Peter Morville, if I may, I've read where you are suggesting that the government move aggressively to create kind of open realms here of data about the physical world that we'd have universal access to.
Yeah, that was a half-serious suggestion that, just as the government has purchased large amounts of land and opened them up as public parks, that the government take a similar approach with data and to sort of create digital parks. I think, this is a very valid concern, and I see right now with the telecom firms that, are big players in this sort of mobile universe, that there really is a danger that we sort of move to more walled gardens. And what I hope is that we sort of move more towards a true Internet of objects that is just as open as the original Internet.
Let me get another call. Rick is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess I want to introduce a note of discord into the conversation. I've been listening, and I've heard the words fun, and I've heard about surveillance, and that reinforces fear, and I've heard about commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me that a lot of this is just a poor substitute. There's a lot of ingenuity behind it, but very little enlightenment. And it's like, in the case of the Yellow Arrow Project, for example, you'd be much better to talk to people living in a particular area to find out the stories about that place.
But would you? So, I mean, would you be as likely to do that as if you could just punch in the number and learn? I mean, I'm thinking, Rick,
well,
of years ago, people would carve, the heart in the side of a tree, Bobby plus
yeah.
Sue. Somebody look on later and be touched by that. Is Yellow Arrow so different?
Well, it's democratic in terms of, being available, but it's not, doesn't ensure democratic participation.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can sit on a porch and tell stories and pass on wisdom. Not everybody has their cell phone available and to punch in the numbers.
Yeah.
So the other thing that worries me is that it reinforces class divisions and privileges people who are fully part of the information age and not those people who need information just as much.
Yeah, we got it. Mike Leibold, what do you say to that concern?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, there are some wonderful standards efforts that have been underway a long time since the Clinton and Gore information revolution. Vice President Gore particularly foresaw this kind of revolution and instigated a lot of work to make information available in standard formats. And then this notion about equity and access, it's turning out that the cell phone really is the world computer. And if cell phones are equipped with Wi-Fi access, then they don't need to necessarily have to dial into a commercial service. Wi-Fi can give you location information and access to the web in a way that doesn't cost money and in a way that doesn't reveal your location.
And would be as democratic as the telephone, ultimately, you're suggesting, which not everybody has, but almost everybody has.
These devices are going to be cheap enough so that even relatively less privileged people are going to have access to geospatial information.
Steve is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say I'm really interested in the project in general, and I would also like to say that there's more uses to it that I was thinking of as I was driving around.
Yeah.
I happen to be a salesman, and I'm on the road a lot, and I see a lot of wildlife, and sometimes I'd like to know what it is I'm looking at, and I think that, you know, sometimes just the general population could have input to that, and if the general population is telling everybody what they've seen and where, wildlife biologists don't necessarily have to be out there in the field necessarily to see everything firsthand. It can, a lot of birds and you know, other things can be tracked by the general population.
So the world is an open book. Here's a wetland. Here's what lives in it. Here's its history. And you might drive by and have all that at your fingertips, Steve.
Right, right in my little cell phone. I could be reading something about a bird or a rodent that I happen to be seeing.
So there's the vote of human curiosity looking to be satisfied here. Steve, our time is short, but thanks very much for your call. Peter Morville, on the one hand, this can be so exciting. On the other hand, we've talked some about how the sort of threat to privacy, the potential downside of this. How do you imagine human culture interacting with this technology over time? Are we going to adopt a different understanding of what we should expect to know about the world and what we expect to be known about ourselves?
Well, I see the GeoWeb as an important part of a broader trend towards what I call ambient findability, which is a world where we can find anyone or anything from anywhere at any time. And as a librarian and an information architect, I'm really sensitive to the huge challenges of designing interfaces that actually work for people so that they can find what they're looking for, so that they don't become lost. And I think that is going to be a kind of a central challenge as we move forward. How do we design user-friendly systems when we're dealing with this tremendous complexity that bridges both the physical and the digital world?
So a big challenge there, and we can certainly understand that. Many, no doubt, generations to go through in refining that. But on the other side of that, what about people who want to get lost or at least not be ambient findable?
We want to kind of retain a place for serendipity and for browsing and for the fun of discovery. And I'm not worried that we will lose that. The challenge is going to be to sort of help people find what they need when they need it. And we're going to have a lot of surprises along the way.
Mike Leopold, what's the timetable look like here? People wading into this very fast already. When does this kind of more universally tagged physical world become something that everybody's going to be aware of?
Well, I think the next 2 years are going to be really telling. We see Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo racing ahead to build these capabilities. Now they're joined by the professional GIS companies like ESRI, Environmental Systems Group in Redlands, the leading mapping firm, to make this information available. The challenge is to make Esri, Microsoft, Google and Yahoo, MapQuest and others, data interoperable and work together. And there are, right there in Boston, groups of people who are leading a national effort to come up with a standard way to geocode information. And so that's going to be hitting the mainstream in the next few months, in fact.
Wow, that is a near time horizon. What a picture being laid out here. Mike Leopold at the Institute for the Future, I'm very grateful to you for being with us this hour and painting that picture for us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. I've enjoyed being here.
And Peter Morville in Ann Arbor, Michigan, author of Ambient Findability. Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
And thanks for having me, Tom.
A lot of the sites mentioned in this hour are at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.